Okay, Soren is going to continue his proof tomorrow for his lecture. What I'm going to lecture about today is an introduction to toric and lattice ideals. They generalize the ideals of projective toric varieties as studied in algebraic geometry. However, this more general definition is applicable to a number of different fields and applied problems of interest, such as integer programming, applications in statistics, and so forth. And today, what I'd like to do is give an introduction and explain how one computes these ideals and what the sort of basic geometry of these ideals are as algebraic varieties. Okay, so, by the way, there are two different terms meant by the term lattice. A lattice is a special kind of partially ordered set, but that's not how I'm using it today. A lattice is also a grid of integer lattice points. That is how I'm using it today. So lattice for me, for us, is a subgroup L contained in the n-dimensional integer lattice z to the n. Okay, and we think of this as a group under addition of vectors. And then there's some properties of L we're concerned about. L is saturated if L is equal to the span of L. And when I mean span of L, I mean as a subset of Rn. So you just take the linear subspace as a real subspace of the real vector space Rn, and then you intersect this back with the integer lattice points, z to the n. And so L is saturated if it consists of all integer lattice points in its real span. Otherwise, we define LSAT to be this way. Define the saturation of L to be equal to the span of L intersect z to the n. And if we're not in the case where L was originally saturated, then this will be a larger group with the same span. And we can consider the quotient LSAT mod L, and it is a finite group. And let's say, of order E, and then what we say is E is the index of L in its saturation. Okay? So now, if you let L act on z to the n by translation, then we can understand pretty well what the orbits. The orbits are the cosets of L in z to the n. And what we want to do is we want to intersect these cosets with the first orthant. And the first orthant in this integral case is the natural numbers to the nth power. So what we're going to do is we're going to say that two points A and B, which are integer lattice points in the first orthant, are equivalent mod L. It's just another way of saying that they're in the same orbit when you think of this as an action. But that's another way of just saying that their difference, A minus B, is in L, which is saying that they represent the same element in the quotient. A is equal to B in the quotient group z to the n mod L. And the class of ideals we're going to be studying are a special class of binomial ideals. The lattice ideal I sub L expresses this equivalence using monomials. So in other words, the definition of I sub L is contained inside the polynomial ring on n variables. And we have the difference of monomials x to the a minus x to the b belongs to I sub L precisely when a is equivalent to b mod L, which we simply express as a minus b belongs to L. Okay? So there's a way of thinking about this, which is a nice way of thinking of the polynomial ring, is to identify the first orthon of integer lattice points with the monomials in our polynomial ring. And so if we call this ring S, then we think of S as being what's called a semigroup algebra. So we write K brackets a semigroup. In this case, it's the semigroup consisting of all non-negative integer lattice points under addition. And the idea is that the semigroup law tells you sort of the exponent law. In other words, it encodes, if you think of your monomials in this ring as being elements of the semigroup, then the way you multiply monomials is use the addition law for elements in the semigroup. And what we've done with this equivalence relation is we're describing a new ring, which is, if we look at what happens when we impose this equivalence relation on the monomials of the first orthon, S mod I to the L can be thought of as a semigroup algebra by modding out by this equivalence relation. Okay. Now, when L is not saturated, then there'll be interesting effects there. There'll be some torsion in that semigroup, but another way of presenting this . So there's a situation when this arises, which we'd like to consider sort of a partial converse. Let's consider that we have any monomial subring. Okay, so I have a monomial subring K of X1, I mean, of X to the A1, comma, comma, x to the an, sitting as a subring inside the polynomial ring x to the 1, x1 through xd. Okay? So what I mean by this notation is I mean the ring which has monomials consisting of 1, these monomials, and any products you can form from these monomials. And in general, though, a given monomial in this ring here may be formed in different ways as products of these monomials. And we would have a binomial ideal telling us equivalent ways of forming product monomials from this basis or starting set. So this generates the monomial subring. These monomial subrings can be modeled in this way. Okay? So the idea is, we look at what's happening we form a map from n to the n to the n to the d given by matrix A, and the map is simply defined to take the ith coordinate basis vector of n to the n and map it to the ith exponent vector of a generator of the monomial subring. And so we get a matrix A, and we can think of this matrix as having columns A1 through AN. So this is a D row by N column matrix. Okay? And this matrix, more generally, can be thought of as giving a map from Z to the N to to z to the L, just extend it, you know, d to the by linearity. And then the kernel of A defines a lattice for us, and this lattice is saturated. And then this is an example of this construction, because what we get is we get this monomial subring to be equal, to be presented as k of n to the n mod L for our L, which we can think of by, you know, forming new variables y1 through yn, and modding out by the lattice ideal I sub L defined by L. Okay? Okay, so there's an example of this which we've seen many times, so I'll put it up quickly again, is because I'm going to look at the structure of this a little more closely from this point of view. Twisted cubic, now we take P1 to be 3 by Ft goes to S cubed, S squared, T, Ft squared, T cubed, and the corresponding ring map that we get by going backwards to K of Ft, which sends A to S cubed, B to S squared T, C to ST squared, and D to T cubed, has image K, the monomial subring, K, S cubed, S squared T, ST squared, and T cubed, okay, as a subring of K of S, T. And here, it fits into this pattern, 3, 2, 1, 0, 0, 1, 2, 3. And the lattice, I'll need it later, is minus 1, 2, minus 1, 0, and minus 1, 1, 1, minus 1. And if you remember, there aren't only two generators to the twisted cubic, rather we have three generators. The lattice ideal is b squared minus ac, bc minus ad, and c squared minus bd. So what is the correspondence? Well, this process of taking a difference of monomials giving each vector, giving each difference of exponent vectors giving each vector in the lattice matches up this first vector with our first generator, matches up our second vector with our second generator, but to actually generate the lattice ideal, we need to find this third element also. So part of what I want you to understand as a part of today's lecture is what is the geometry of such lattice ideals that would allow us to find a complete set of generators from a basis for the kernel of A. So there are two caveats which I'd like to raise at this point. Okay, so the first caveat, if you ever go to program this, you can get in trouble quickly this way, is that a linear basis for the kernel of A as a real map, as a map, you know, if you think of the map from Rn to Rd defined by A, that happens to be integral. You know, so that it just happens that the vectors that we come up with as a basis for this real subspace of Rn, if we happen to see integers there, we can't simply take those vectors as a basis. They need not form a lattice basis for L. In general, if you're sloppy at this point, you get some L prime, which is finite index in L, and it fails, in other words, it fails to be saturated. Okay, so in other words, you can't just apply Gaussian elimination and do the usual algorithm for finding the kernel and just grab it. You have to use a refined version of Gaussian elimination, which is designed to work correctly as an integer algorithm. And an example of such algorithms, there are various ones you can consider, is like Smith normal form. Okay, or what are other ones? Pardon? Okay, fine. So the second caveat is that by the same token, a lattice basis for L need not yield ideal basis for I sub L. And we have an example of that above. So the twisted cubic is already a good example of that phenomena. So we're curious what it takes in order to find such bases. So the first step in working with lattice ideals is we need to have a secure way of getting a correct generating set for a lattice ideal. And we'd like to understand how hard that is. So in a way, and again, we're going to be very interested in Betti numbers, syzygies. And, you know, in the case of monomial ideals, it seemed like, okay, the generators, we know the generators, that's how we describe a monomial ideal. But sure, it's interesting to know the higher syzygies of a monomial ideal. It relates to the Hilbert function. It's an example of these regularity phenomena. Here, the same questions arise, and as you can see, it's possible to state the problem in such a way that you don't even know a priori the degrees of the generators. So the same operations, the same ideas for using simplicial homology and so forth to calculate Betti numbers, we're already interested in knowing what the Betti numbers are for generators in this situation. And I'm going to show you an algorithm for actually finding the generators from this description of an ideal. So in order to do that, I need a geometric view of a lattice ideal I sub L. In fact, what I'd like to do is, in fact, consider more generally the case of binomial ideals. Okay, so now we're backing off, and we're going to take an arbitrary x to the am minus x to the bm. I'm going to take an arbitrary binomial ideal sitting inside the polynomial ring in n variables. Okay, so I can be just awful. The worst case bounds for various operations, complexity theory of ideals, are already realized by how badly behaved, at least the known bounds, are realized by how badly behaved a binomial ideal can be. The definitive paper that started this study, other papers relate to this, Mayer and Meyer, in 82, published a computer science paper which, in particular, addresses the question of deciding, you know, how hard is it, you know, to decide the question, yes or no, does a given other binomial belong to I? And the expression which cancels out to correctly show that this is indeed a combination of these can be of double exponential degree. And this relates to the fact that the non-commutative version of this is actually undecidable. It's the famous word problem that's the first thing people think about when they talk about Turing machines. So, on the other hand, the geometry of this, and sort of the interior of our space we want to study the geometry, is quite simple and beautiful. So, what I want to study now is I want to study G. G is going to be a zero locus. It's going to be a subset of affine n space over my field where I'm going to strike out all the coordinate hyperplanes. So in other words, I'm only considering vectors whose coordinates are non-zero. And I'm going to define G. I want G to be equal to the vanishing locus of our ideal I. So in other words, if I take points of the form G is G1 through Gn, and all of the Gi are not equal to zero, then the property is that G to the A actually equals G to the B for all binomials X to the A minus X to the B belonging to our ideal I. And I want to ask what this set looks like. Okay, so what we do is let's look one binomial at a time for any binomial X to the A minus X to the B belonging to our ideal. Let's write G as above, and let's pick another element H, similarly broken out, and then let's define the term-wise product. So I'm gonna, when I write G times H, I mean G1, H1 through Gn, Hn, taking term-wise products, okay? And then what I want to do is calculate what happens with respect to various operations for elements of G versus our binomial ideal. So, if G to the A equals G to the B, and H to the A equals H to the B, then if you look at what, you take the product that defined G to the A, X to the, H to the A, and the way, it just means G1 to the A1, G2 to the A2, dot, 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 H1 to the A1, H2 to the A2, dot, dot, dot. You collect terms, this is the same the same value as G to the A, H to the A, which we can now say is G to the B, H to the B, which is just GH to the B. Okay, so I leave it as an exercise, the following other properties. Also, if you define G inverse to simply be G1 inverse through Gn inverse, which I can do because I've assumed all of my coordinates are non-zero, this acts as an inverse. And there's an element 1, I'll write it under bar under it, which is just the vector of all 1s, which pretty clearly any binomial, any pure binomial vanishes on this vector because both sides evaluate to 1. This acts as an identity. So what we see is that G is an abelian group. Okay. So we'd like to understand this abelian group. So I ask, what is the structure of G? Okay, so there's a paper on general binomial ideals by Bernd Sternfels and David Eisenbud. Their definition is somewhat broader than what we're considering, and we'll see in an example that theirs is, in a way, a more natural class that is closed under primary decompositions and so forth. But one sees a picture of what an arbitrary binomial ideal looks like, that which I would like to sort of sketch for you right now. Okay, and the idea is that you can recover a lattice from an arbitrary binomial ideal I. So we define L from I by simply defining L to be the lattice generated by all differences B minus A whenever we have an anomial X to the A minus X to the B belonging to our ideal I. okay? And then I also want to consider LSAT. In other words, it's very easy to construct examples where this lattice that you get this way generated won't be saturated. I want to take LSAT. The distinction, the way we think of saturated lattices, is when we have a saturated lattice, it means we can find a matrix A mapping Z to the N to Z to the D for some D, which expresses the saturation as the kernel of the matrix. I mean, you know, take a Smith normal form kernel for the basis and just transpose it, and you get the same situation. And this is going to set us up in the original setup that we were in, because this will give a rational parameterization of the component, let's call it G sub 1, of G through this point 1. Okay? So somehow saturated lattices correspond to irreducible varieties, and we're going to find an irreducible variety that's part of G in this way. Okay. So what we do is we use the map to define, we define a ring map now to polynomial ring on this side, and on this side I'm going to have a Laurent polynomial ring of sorts. In other words, I'm allowing both positive and negative exponents for the y's. I'm going to go y1 through yd and allow positive and negative exponents. And I'm going to think of this map as being induced by A in the sense that if I have a monomial over here, x to the b is mapped to the monomial y to the ab. Right? So basically what this does is, how do we think about, I mean, if you think of a polynomial ring as standing for affine space, then we have a polynomial ring localized by, we're allowed to divide by each variable. We're localizing away from the coordinate hyperplanes in affine space. Then we think of the Laurent polynomial ring as being a model for affine D space removing the coordinate hyperplanes. Okay? So in other words, the interesting points that make sense in terms of this polynomial ring are the points in D space which have all non-zero coordinates. And we get a reverse map whose image is this component I'm interested in, G sub 1, which sits inside G, which sits inside A sub N. And the parameterization just takes the columns of the matrix A in order to, you know, given a point, you map that point, you exponentiate that point with respect to the columns of the matrix A. And since A might have negative entries, we needed to be sure that our points, were non-zero so that we could, in fact, invert them if necessary for the coordinates. And so this is a rational parameterization. And the other thing that's interesting here is that we can look at the quotient of the entire group by this one connected component, and it's discrete, it's in fact finite, and the other thing that they observe is that it can be identified with the index of L in its saturation is the same as the total number of components of G. So we have multiple components, and one of them goes to this point, 1. And so there's a continuous aspect to the group that we've defined, and there's a finite aspect to this group that we've defined. And so that's how nice a given, an arbitrary binomial ideal looks this nice away from the coordinate hyperplanes. So, of course, given this lattice, we can consider the ideal, the lattice ideal, I sub L. I differs from I sub L precisely by, and I sub L defines just the set G and nothing extra, precisely by primary components on the coordinate hyperplanes. For example, in this paper, they generalize binomials to having coefficients and to having monomials and binomials, both acceptable members of the ideal. And it's in that sense, the primary components supported on the coordinate hyperplanes, they need not be defined by binomials. You can have monomial ideals defining the primary components. And they need not be embedded primary components. They could be off on their own. We'll see that in an example later. So. But this is important for us if we're interested in working with lattice ideals for the nice applications in which lattice ideals are the right object. Because if we want to compute I sub L from I, then what you do is you carry out an algebraic operation which corresponds to erasing the components on the coordinate hyperplanes. So in a way, that's what we're going to discuss in the rest of the lecture. In particular, if we want to compute I sub L from a lattice, which is one version of the problem that we've been considering whenever we wanted to, you know, study rational curve given by monomials and so forth. We define crudely I by just using the generators of L. As I said before, that won't necessarily give us a generating set for the lattice ideal. It's going to be wrong. But now we understand how it's wrong. It's going to be wrong by components defined on the hyperplanes. So what we can do is we can come up with this ideal I very quickly just by glancing at a set of generators of L and writing down the corresponding binomials. And then we apply the above step. So the last thing I'll do is an example that carries this out. But in order to carry this out, I have to tell you what this algebraic operation is that corresponds to erasing components. Okay, so finally, remember the word algorithms actually was somewhere in this workshop title, right? Finally, we're actually looking at an algorithm. You know, so how is it that we remove components? So I want to give you a geometric intuition, not assuming you're an algebraic geometer, to try to explain how algebraic geometers think of this question in order to see what algebra it is we need to do in order to get rid of these and components and clean up I to get the ideal I sub L. So this is a familiar effect. I mean, it's one that, you know, computer scientists butt their heads against, even in particular, which is, let's look at a simpler problem in which the same issue arises. Let's take two generating sets for an affine ideal. Let's say F1 through FL. And let's say G1 through GM, Now I'm thinking of arbitrary polynomials. I'm no longer in the binomial setting. I'm just writing down two lists of arbitrary polynomials. And let's say they both generate the inhomogeneous ideal I contained in n variables, in the polynomial ring over n variables, x1 through xn. See, when you have a grading, when you're working with homogeneous ideals, then there is a rough notion of minimality for generating set. The Betti numbers tell you how many generators are minimal in each degree that the Betti numbers measure. But in the affine setting, where we're inhomogeneous, there is no one crisp notion of which are the right minimal generators. And you can have different cardinalities of generating sets and not be sure which one you want to be working with. So these define an affine variety, in other words, a zero locus, X, sitting inside, you know, affine n-space. So there's an important way in which these two sets might differ, okay? The important way is if we homogenize with respect to a new variable, X-naught, okay? So one could give a formula for homogenizing that the homogenization of a polynomial F is equal to X-naught raised the degree of F times F, where you plug in x1 over x0, dot blah blah blah, xn over x0. But this is really a straightforward process. You just look term by term at each of the terms of your polynomial, and if the degree is less than the total degree of the polynomial, you fix it by multiplying that term by an appropriate power of x0, which brings the degree of that term up to the total degree. And that gives you a polynomial all of whose terms are the same degree. And now we can think of that as defining projective rather than affine varieties. So what we do is we define, say, our first ideal to be defined by the homogenizations of our first set, F1 through FL, homogenized. This is going to be taken inside K of X0 through XN. And then our second ideal, I2, we'll just replace by the homogenizations of the G's, sits inside the same ring. This defines two projective varieties, both sitting in projective N space. And they're the same affine variety. If we set, X0 equal to 1, that corresponds to intersecting each of these projective varieties with the particular affine n-space away from x0 equals 0, and we get the same variety back both times, which is just our original affine variety x. But the way in which these two varieties can differ is they can differ markedly in terms of the component sitting at the hyperplane at infinity, x equals 0. So I want you to recognize that this is in some sense the same phenomena as we're asking over there. That our arbitrary binomial ideal I is a sense is the same as I sub L away from the coordinate hyperplanes, but along the coordinate hyperplanes, all hell can break loose. And what we're saying here is with an unfortunate choice of generators for an affine ideal, we can have all hell break loose on the hyperplane at infinity. And this is, in a sense, what's lurking behind the Mayer and Meyer results about complexity of ideal membership. Is that what you see may look quite simple in the affine part, but there's such a monstrous amount of junk at infinity that it drives up the degree double exponentially when you try to compute anything. Okay, so there's a definition. In a way, this is a good example because this predates the study of Grobner bases, and the problem is well understood what you want to do. There's a notion of a homogenizing basis. Okay. An homogenizing basis for our ideal I. I mean, there isn't a notion of a minimal basis, but we can at least say if we chose a right basis, a good basis that has a in a sense is minimal. Homogenizing basis has the property that its homogenization defines the closure of our original variety in Pn. In other words, the affine variety meets the hyperplane at infinity. We take the closure, it's going to fill in at infinity. But there's no new stuff. There's no primary components at infinity other than the components that went with the affine part of the variety. So what you see is what you get. It's WYSIWYG away from infinity on your algebraic variety. Now that we have Grobner bases, there's a Grobner basis which can compute this. An ordinary affine Grobner basis is, if we take a degree first Grobner basis, in other words, it's degree respecting, that first and foremost, one term is greater than another term if it has greater total degree than the other term. Then what you get for taking a Grobner basis with respect to any degree respecting term order is you get, in particular, a homogenizing basis. So this does all the work to grind away and erase all the extra components supported at the hyperplane at infinity. And the fact that they can be quite bad, according to complexity results, means that it can be quite hard to compute this Grobner basis. And it's a justification for projective geometry. The same way that people at first had trouble accepting the complex numbers, if they wanted to do a calculation, they knew had a real answer. Even if you're only interested in calculations involving affine rings and affine spaces, these phantom, if you will, components sitting at the hyperplane infinity are totally controlling how hard you work. And it's better to just take projective space and actually see them rather than sort of avoiding them. Okay. So what is an algebraic view? Let's put this in a more modern algebraic view. There's an operation . So again, I'm not yet restricting to a binomial ideal. I'm considering an arbitrary ideal sitting in x1 through xn. And I see what's special about this situation is it's just removing components at infinity. So, you could think of it, this is useful. If you can get your components at infinity, then here's a way to dump them. But what's a way of directly dealing with components if instead of knowing they're at infinity, we know that they lie along a particular hypersurface, say f equals 0? Well, there's an algebraic operation, I colon f infinity. It's a slight generalization of the ordinary colon in commutative algebra. And it's defined to be the ideal generated by all g such that f to the mg belongs to our ideal for some m. So it's an exercise in commutative algebra. So first of all, how do you think about this in words? It simply means divide by f whenever possible, as much as possible. So an ordinary ideal quotient is a direct generalization of dividing two polynomials, assuming you can. Sometimes polynomials don't divide each other. But so here, this is a generalization where some of the polynomials in I won't be divisible by f, and we leave them alone, and others will be divisible by f, possibly many times, in which case we'll divide by f as much as we're allowed to. And that gives us a better ideal in a certain sense. The way to understand how better this ideal is suppose that I is in fact primary. So there, and now let's assume that we know the associated prime, P. Well, there are two cases. Either F belongs to the associated prime, or F doesn't belong to the associated prime. Okay. In the first case, if f belongs to the associated prime, then some power of f actually belongs to our ideal. But that implies that, by this definition, that 1 belongs to the ideal quotient, which means that our ideal quotient is in fact the unit ideal. So the unit ideal has the empty set as zero locus. The one vanishes nowhere. So the way you think of this first line geometrically is that f belonging to the prime associated with I means that the radical, the support of I, the points in the zero locus of I, all lie on the hypersurface f equals zero. And so if I defines a variety that lies on the hypersurface f equals zero, then this operation zaps it. It just goes away. Okay? So the other part we want to check then is what happens if f doesn't belong to the prime? Well, if g f to the m belongs to our ideal, in fact, G belongs to our ideal. If you always thought the definition of a primary ideal was somewhat convoluted, this is one of my favorite ways of thinking about what the point is of that definition. It exactly makes this work. What that tells us is that the same operation totally leaves alone any ideal whose associated prime whose zero locus isn't supported on f equals zero. Okay? So what happens is this operation in fact commutes with Hicking intersections. So you can study what happens to an arbitrary ideal when you take this operation by just thinking of that arbitrary ideal as an intersection of primary components. And then each piece of the zero locus on f equals zero zapped away. Each piece of the zero locus off f equals zero is left intact. And so this operation exactly scrubs all the components on a given hypersurface f equals zero and leaves alone the remaining components. So now we can add a line, which we couldn't add before, to operation over here. We now know what the algebraic operation is that we want to carry out. It's that I sub L is equal to our original ideal I, and then we take the polynomial, the product of the variables, x1 through xn, and we erase by that polynomial, we take the ideal quotient with that polynomial. So this operation is precisely scrub away any components supported on any coordinate hyperplane. And when we do that, we're left with just this group G that we looked at earlier, which is the zero locus of I sub L, which is the idea we really want. Okay? So it becomes interesting to ask, okay, so how can we do this operation efficiently, say, on the computer? Well, a simple case to look at, which is the case we reduced to on the computer, is now we consider, for example, Macaulay 1 is strictly homogeneous for some grading. It could be a fancy grading, but consider now a homogeneous ideal, I sitting inside, and now let me add my same homogenizing variable x0. So I have x0 as a homogenizing variable. And I'm going to do Grubner bases, but I want to pick a term order which avoids x0. You know, such as, I mean, you never end up when you run the algorithm comparing monomials to different degrees if you're homogeneous. But, you know, for the sake of completeness, let's just say we first sort by degree. But, you know, having sorted by degree, what we want to next do is sort by the degree in all the variables but x0. Okay? And the effect of doing that is when we compare different terms, let's just think of the term as a term as x0 to some power times smudge would be the rest of the term, is going to be greater than x0 to some other power smudge m is greater than L. In other words, later in the term ordering, we get higher powers of X naught. So now you think, what do Grodner races do? Well, they bang lead terms against each other, canceling them out, getting rid of them, and what becomes a new lead term sort of works its way back in the term ordering. So this is like a sifting process. The most familiar use of Grodner bases, perhaps, is to eliminate variables. So you try to make the variables you're getting rid of show up in your lead term. So when you cancel them out, they're gone. This is the opposite process. Higher powers of X naught are appearing late in our polynomials. So we keep canceling these polynomials against each other, canceling off lead terms which are not very divisible by X naught. We end up producing polynomials which are more divisible by X naught. So in other words, the algorithm is you take a Grodner basis with respect to this order, any order that's constructed like this, and divide it by X naught wherever possible. And what this computes is this computes I colon X naught to the infinity. Okay. So if you were to want to erase all the components supported on a particular coordinate hyperplane, then you would simply arrange that coordinate be X naught and do this. And a simple Grodner basis without any translation to it will have that effect for us. So there's, in fact, several ways of viewing this problem. And this is not a particularly efficient approach. When people have applied this to integer programming, for example, find it's much faster to get rid of one variable at a time. I mean, to erase along one coordinate hyperplane at a time. So that takes directly this form. Okay. However, this is enough to turn the general problem into this special case, because if you start out with the problem we considered above, which is F is an arbitrary polynomial in X1 through Xn, what we do is we form the new ring K of X naught through Xn, and we throw in the relation X naught is really a synonym for F. You know, if F had degree D, then we'd have to introduce a new variable of degree D to keep everything homogeneous. But now, you know, so when we study a given ideal, we just throw that ideal on top of this equation and just grind the whole thing with Grodner bases and apply the top technique. And the effect of erasing X naught in this ring is the same as erasing F. And then we just pull the answer back to the original ring. So it is possible to directly compute this. And you know, I must admit, when I'm just typing by hand on the computer, I'll throw this in and see if it works. And I won't bother doing it variable by variable in a loop unless it's a hard enough problem that I need to do that. Okay. So I want to close with one example and show you how this works for the twisted cubic. By the way, there are many problems open for toric ideals and lattice ideals that are fairly well understood for monomial ideals. And there's a very close connection between the two. So there's a lot of room for this to all get straightened out in the next few years. Okay, so let's go back and ask another way we could actually compute the twisted cubic using this machinery. Okay, so you remember we have the matrix 3, 2, 1, 0. 0, 1, 2, 3, and then L was the kernel of A, was given by the two vectors minus 1, 2, minus 1, 0, and minus 1, 1, 1, minus 1. Then the prescription that's given on the top board here, which I saved, is to just, you know, blindly define an ideal I with binomials corresponding to those two given generators of our lattice. So we would take b squared minus ac and bc minus ad. So this corresponds to the first generator. This corresponds to the second generator. And this is wrong. This is wrong as an ideal for the twisted cubic. In fact, it's 2 degree, two surfaces in P3. It's a complete intersection. So Bezout's theorem applies, and it cuts out a degree 4 curve in P3. But in fact, we can understand that degree 4 curve, degree 4 in the sense that if you held up a plane to measure it by, it would go through the plane a total of 4 times. But the laundry list of what's in that degree 4 curve is that our degree 3 curve, the twisted cubic, is one of the components. So we have the map P1 goes to P3, which I have been putting up many, many times. But then we also have, so this is degree 3 curve, but we also have a different line which makes up the remaining degree, and that line is S comma T maps to 0, 0, S comma T. And the way when you get used to spotting this right away is there's an obvious defect in this set of generators which tells you that there's some junk sitting at infinity, which is that the letters A and B together cover all the terms. Right? I mean, every term on both sides of every binomial on both sides of each binomial either has an A in it or a B in it or both. Right? In this case, A or B. So if we set A equals B equals 0, we kill both sides both times. And all this line is the line defined by A equals B equals 0. Okay? So in general, we don't have the foresight of knowing where, which coordinate hyperplanes have the junk we're trying to get rid of. Here we do, which will save us some time. I don't have to go through and scrub each variable. What I want to do is I want to scrub the variable A. I want to kill any component supported on the coordinate plane A equals 0. Okay? So I choose a term order which avoids A. Which all that means is that, you know, if there's more A in one term than another, I'm going to make that term last. Okay, so what do I get for lead terms when I do that? Well, this is a lead term because it has no A in it, the other term has A in it. This is a lead term, it has no A in it, the other term has A in it. So any term order which avoids A is going to choose these two lead terms. And I want to apply the Grubner basis algorithm, which means I want to lift a minimal syzygy of the monomial ideal and see what happens when I try to express it as a syzygy of the original ideal. That's the real idea behind Grubner bases, is lifting syzygies like that. So I take B squared and BC as my monomial ideal, and I support it on this trivial cellular resolution, which is this line segment going from B squared to BC. And what syzygy, so this has total degree B squared C. So what syzygy do I read off of this? Well, from B squared C, I step down forward by B to get to the term BC, but at the same time, if I step off the back edge of this arrow, I step down negatively by C to get to B squared, and I get this monomial syzygy. And the idea of Grubner bases is I want to try to lift this syzygy and see what happens to the entire polynomials that gave me these monomials. So I take B times B squared minus AC minus C times BC minus AD, and when I calculate what this gives me, it gives me it wasn't working out. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you noticed the stress in my voice. Yeah, okay, you're right. Thank you. B squared minus BC minus AD. It's like when you practice an instrument and you make a mistake and you go back over that sheet of music, you make exactly the same mistake, right? Okay, B squared minus AC, and what I get is AC squared, this term is positive, these two terms cancel out, that was the whole point, minus ABD. But now the whole idea, I'm going to stop here, because you know, what I would do is check that I had a complete Grubner basis, and I'd go look through the entire Grubner basis for places I could divide by A. But this is exactly the place I was waiting for. I divide by A here, and I get the form C squared minus BD, and that is the remaining generator that I need that completes the description of I sub L. So this theory, in terms of, you know, the group G and then the junk at infinity we want to get rid of, works out beautifully in this example, that one way we can compute this, the equations of the twisted cubic is as I've described here, and this works in general. Okay, so have a great lunch.